The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose Tastytrade. Tastytrade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low-capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tastytrade. Join the club, genius. Tasty Trading is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
It's Jim Cramer here. You're listening to the opening bell of CNBC's Squawk on the Street. Don't miss a minute of the action.
Good Wednesday morning. Welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm Carl Quintanilla with Jim Cramer and David Faber. Futures are mostly steady, coming off those record closes for the S&P, the NASDAQ, the Russell, the Dow Transports. Busy setup as this historic month for IPOs kicks in with the debut of DoorDash, pricing at 102. Our roadmap begins with the IPO banner year. DoorDash is set to debut today, pricing above the range, valuing the company at $39 billion. The CEO will join us exclusively this hour.
Plus, those records for the market roll on. Futures pointing to a higher open, the S&P topping 3,700. And as COVID cases continue to surge with vaccine hopes on the horizon, Delta Airlines CEO is going to join us. It's a first on CNBC. Of course, we'll discuss his outlook for his troubled industry. Carl.
All right, Jim, let's start with DoorDash. You were just talking about it with Andrew and Becky and Joe. Your point yesterday was great story, but be careful.
Well, look, I think that there are a couple of things that are going in favor of it. There are people who know the brand. When people know the brand, the younger investors just say, you know what, get me some. I don't want them to lose what discipline they have, because then we're starting to get into a 1998, 1999 period where they put market orders in, and whatever price you get may end up being the top price for the day. What I do think is important is people recognize that they're going to have easy comparisons for a little bit. But then, you know, when people can start going out again, they will choose to go out as much as they will use DoorDash. I don't think DoorDash goes away. I think that it's more of a duopoly than it's been before because of Uber Eats. Good business. Great business. I don't know. It is still a delivery system. It's still they've had to make a suburban. They've made a suburban footprint, which is really brilliant. But, David, in the end, we know that the moat is only as good as the fact that they have low prices and they've got good technology.
Right. Now, they've had very strong revenue growth. But to your point, Jim, this may be a unique opportunity that they've seen over this last, let's call it, 9 months in terms of growth. And the comparisons will get tougher. They've got to a year from now, when hopefully we're all back to sort of normal behavior and people are not staying home quite as often and ordering in quite as much. You'd expect that that will reduce. It's going to trade at a multiple to revenues that is going to be double digits.
I'm worried about
that. And I wonder how you view it from a valuation perspective. Obviously, great growth, huge market share, 50%, which you do also have to wonder how much bigger can you get than that?
Well, look, the one thing is certain, Carl, is that this newer brand of investors I've been profiling on Mad Money have a lot of capital. A lot of people say, well, where did it come from? I don't want to even ask that. I just say they like things. And when they like things and they use things, actually the old Peter Lynch model from Magellan Fund for a long time at Fidelity, they're willing to keep buying. Look at Snowflake. I mean, when I speak to Frank Slootman, he's not sure exactly who his investors are, but he knows a lot of them are retail investors. DoorDash is used by a lot of younger people, both in the suburbs and in the cities. So I think that you're going to see incredible enthusiasm. I wish that people would use limit orders, but that is a parlance, Carl, that they don't understand. They don't get that.
Yeah. It does sort of remind me, Jim, of another call out this morning, and that's from J.P. Morgan. They cut CrowdStrike. They cut DocuSign, they cut Okta, they cut Zoom, not because the business is going to take a turn for the worse, but they say post-vaccine, you could see some of these high multiple names at least underperform the software industry average.
Well, but I mean, I read this piece.
Is that all part of a piece?
Yeah, look, I did a piece last night about how Okta's one of the favorites of this new cohort, and it's up a great deal. I use that, as I often talk about it on the show, as being that's the one that you watch to see if there's a turn. They keep hitting the numbers, and the numbers are amazing, and the stock goes up every time. If they keep hitting the numbers, at what point do some of the people who work at Okta or some of the insiders at Okta say, David, we've made a lot of money. It's been a great run. Let's issue some stock. because you haven't made a profit until you take it.
That's true. That's true. Wait, but you said the insiders would sell, and then you're also talking about the company issuing stock. Two separate things?
Oh, no, no. Sorry. I'm saying when are the insiders? I'm thinking about the year 2000.
Yeah.
Where the insiders said, you know what, there's pretty good prices here. But they haven't sold.
I mean, the insiders have
the insiders.
Okay, I thought you were bringing up the idea of the company selling.
You know, Todd McKinnon is the CEO, and he loves the company. And this new breed of investors, the new breed of insiders, David, they just don't sell much. And it is rather incredible.
They don't, and they don't ring a bell. And I can even look back now. I don't know what you would point to as the factor that turned things completely in 2000. Why we hit our high went on March 10th, 2000, and then went down more or less enormously from there. I mean, what was it at that point?
Well, I thought
we talked about valuation for years.
Well, we
years.
Had offerings.
I mean, man, Greenspan's comment was 96, wasn't it?
I know, but we had irrational exuberance. We did have offering after offering after offering from insiders, and then the numbers came out, and the numbers were bad. The difference here, for instance, I had Chewy on last night. Now, this is a stock that's just been red hot. I know it didn't go up huge after the quarter, but take a look at what it's done, for heaven's sake. And the insiders, they seem to love it. There's no cash out. They have such a level of belief. At the same time, we get Snowflake. Who are some of the largest shareholders of Snowflake? Berkshire Hathaway, no, not Warren Buffett, another fund manager. You've got you have Mark Benioff in there. You've got some institutional names. And then you've got this weird thing that's happening where you get these stocks to a certain point that even the Tesla, for instance, gets added to the S&P. Rather amazing. And it's a capstone. Carl, back to you.
We're going to talk about Tesla later on this morning, guys. But first, Delta is focusing on holiday travel, obviously, amid the pandemic, and as well as how soon vaccines can get to the public. Let's get to Delta CEO with our Phil LeBeau today. Hey, Phil.
Hey, Carl. Let's bring in Ed Bastian from Delta's headquarters down in Atlanta. Ed, thank you very much for joining us. I know you're just announcing that you're going to be permanently waiving change fees for international flights. We'll talk about that in a little bit, but right out of the gate, I got to ask you about the latest numbers from the TSA. Just 500,000 people screened yesterday. There is a concern, a serious concern within the industry that we're starting to see the slowdown, and people are just saying, that's it. I'm just not going to fly right now. Give me your take on business right now.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me, Phil. Good to be with you. The virus is our top concern, not just for our industry, but for our nation. And while our people are doing a great job of providing a safe travel experience for our customers, including blocking all middle seats through the end of March, enforcing masks, making certain that every experience is clean before we take off, the virus is having an impact. Customers are heeding the warnings of government authorities. The CDC warnings have been important in that regard. Quarantine, stay-at-home restrictions you continue to see are out there. So I would expect that the travel we're going to be seeing for the upcoming Christmas period is going to be similar to what we've experienced over the last few weeks. We're currently at about one-third of normal traffic trends, and I don't see that changing here for the next couple of months. So that's the challenge. The good news is that with the vaccine on the horizon, spring, we know there's enormous pent-up demand. People are waiting to get back out again. And there's a promise that by March, April, May, in that time frame, tens of millions of Americans will have been vaccinated and ready to get on with their lives. And that's what we're looking forward to.
And the passenger levels are right now somewhere between, let's say, 63% and 70%, somewhere in that range, depending on the day of the week. Is that where you expect it to stay leading up to the Christmas holidays, end of the year holidays, and then in the first quarter when we know that it's always the slowest for the airlines? Or does it get even weaker? Do you see a drop down where we see passenger levels down 70-75%?
Well, we're in a period, the month of December, it's really two parts of the month. The first half of December traditionally is a very slow travel period, even in normal times, and we're seeing that with the current month as well. Once we get through the middle part of the month, we do expect to see traffic increase. Though, again, I'm not sure it's going to increase more than maybe a third of what it was a year ago. And then January should probably be another slow travel month. We've raised the cash at Delta. We have over $17 billion in the bank. We'll get through these next few months, and I'm quite optimistic that by the time we get to the spring, we're going to be looking at a real resurgence of demand. People are ready to get back with their lives.
Now, Jim Cramer, it's great to see you. You always come on no matter whether it's good or bad, and that's terrific. Really interesting. You're talking
good
about
to be with
adding,
you, Jim.
Adding a voluntary contact tracing program for inbound international customers, which will provide essential tracing information directly to the CDC. How do you think that will fly? Because I think that that's precisely what we need in this country to make sure that we all feel more secure.
Well, one of the things that's really important, Jim, is that we figure out how we reopen international travel. Domestic travel is moving. The trends aren't good, but it's open. International is the biggest challenge that we have. We need to create quarantine-free lanes of traffic. And the good news at Delta is that we have done that. Starting next week, we'll be launching flights from Atlanta to Rome, as well as from Atlanta to Amsterdam. That will be quarantine-free, meaning that customers will be tested before they get on board the planes. Those planes will be COVID-free as a result of that. And when they land in both Rome as well as in Amsterdam, they won't be subject to local quarantine restrictions. So we've been working closely with the authorities both in Europe as well as in the U.S., the state of Georgia. Tracing, which is a part of this, is voluntary for inbound traffic, but the CDC is seeking information, and we support it, to be able to identify customers coming back into the U.S., whether it's a U.S. customer or an international customer, that in the event of a health emergency, that they be able to notify customers. The important thing, Jim, in all that, though, is the Mayo Clinic, which has been our great partner throughout this entire pandemic journey, has told us with the testing protocols we've put in place on these tests, the odds of someone being subject to a COVID transmission are literally one in a million.
Wow.
So the odds of anything happening on these flights are incredibly low. And that's what we're going to need to do to start reopening the world.
Ed, it's David Faber. You know, when we talk about reopening, we talk about a return to normalization. Many people focused on your industry also, though, wonder, what does the business traveler look like when we get to that point, given the ease with which they have been able to communicate via all sorts of different technologies that perhaps were not really available or useful that long ago? How do you view it? Do you see business travel ever coming back to the levels it may have had in 2019?
I think it's going to take some time, David, but over the next several years, I do see it coming back. Some video technology is here. It's going to continue to be used, no question about it, but it's not a substitute for relationships or doing business. It's a complement, and I think it'll be used in a complementary form. But business has to be done in person. I'm a firm believer of that. I think it's going to take a while before businesses are open again and customers are starting to see and take in visits from sales folks. But people need to get back out and to see their own customers. Remember, business travel is not only the big corporates. There's so many business travelers, many more business travelers. There are small business owners, people that are out on the road. Those are the true road warriors every single day. They need to get back out and be with their customers. So today, our big customers are only back about 15%. I don't see next year it being any more than maybe 40 to 50%. But it's going to take some time. Business travel has always rebounded. It takes a while to come back, but I think it's going to come back before we know it.
Ed, I looked into the Rome flight. We have a business in Italy, and it seems like an extraordinary opportunity, even though Italy is a little dangerous. But can you describe to people this testing process? Because I think if they knew about it, they would be much more inclined to go to places.
Yeah, it's actually a relatively simple process, Jim. Customers will be required to have a PCR test 72 hours in advance. We work with Quest, and we're giving customers the information where they can get those PCR tests. When they arrive at the airport in Atlanta, we will be supplying at no cost to customers a rapid antigen test. It's a 10-minute test. It's the Abbott test. It will be supplied by the Georgia Public Health Authorities. Assuming they pass and they're clear from those two tests, they'll get on the plane. And when they land in Rome, the Italians have the same Abbott antigen test that they'll apply on a rapid basis. So while you're waiting for your luggage or waiting to depart the airport, you'll be given the opportunity to take that test. And assuming you're clear in all three tests, and you should. You'll be free to travel in Italy as well as in Europe, quarantine free.
Hey, Ed, if the rollout of the vaccine is smooth and happens quicker than many people are even forecasting right now, and you do see a surge in demand for the summer, how quickly can you bring the aircraft that you have parked back into service, get the crews in place, get the maintenance facilities ready to handle that resurgence in demand that you're expecting?
Well, we're already ready to go, Phil. We're flying with load factors today that are probably about 40%, 40 to 45%. We're blocking middle seats, as you know, through the end of March. When it's safe, when the vaccines are out in large numbers, that certainly we'll be returning those middle seats back to the market. So we'll have a lot of flying seats that we'll actually start to put customers back into in the spring and the summer. So I don't expect at Delta there's going to be a huge increase in the number of aircraft or departures that are ready. We're ready to go. We've got the seats in the sky today.
And one last question for you, Ed. As you look at the next 3 months or so, you have announced that you're going to be permanently waiving international change fees. There are skeptics out there who say, you know what, we've heard from the airlines who are saying we're getting rid of change fees, and it'll come back in a couple of years when business comes back. You're pledging that you're going to keep these, waive these international change fees for good, correct?
Correct. They're gone for good. We were on this path before the pandemic about eliminating friction points between us and customers, and change fees being one of those. So when the pandemic hit, it was the perfect time to waive them, because we don't want just another reason for why customers are nervous about booking and making advanced travel plans. So any ticket that you purchase going forward from Delta and from any North American destination, there will be no change fee required if you decide to change your plans, whether it's domestic or international.
Ed Bastian, CEO of Delta Airlines, joining us from the Flight Museum down there. It's been a while since I've been down there, but hopefully maybe in the first quarter, second quarter.
We need to get you. We need to get you and Bob back down here, Phil.
We will. Bob's right here. He's ready to go. We'll see you hopefully in the next few months if things slow down in terms of the COVID-19. Carl, what's interesting when you listen to Ed Bastian, and I've heard this from a number of the CEOs, they believe that they have the liquidity in place to weather what's going to be a brutal couple of months in terms of travel demand.
That's been key all year long, Phil. Great interview, and it's going to be a good day when we get you back to Atlanta as well. Phil LeBeau, thanks so much. Lots to get to this morning. We'll talk some FireEye, some JP Morgan, Bank of America, Disney, Apple, and Dwayne Johnson, the Hollywood superstar. We'll talk about the success he's having in the spirits industry, breaking some records with his tequila brand. That and a lot more straight ahead.
Let's get straight to the point. You want to grow your portfolio to fight rising costs of inflation or pay off your debt or anything standing in the way of you and financial freedom, right? Yahoo Finance, our sponsor today, can help. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been helping great investors like you. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just looking for tips, Yahoo Finance makes it super easy by putting all the tools and data you need in one spot. Yahoo Finance takes a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and more. You can securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. That's how Yahoo Finance gives you insights and helps you take a look at your wealth in its entirety. That big picture perspective is what great investors need. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com.
Making travel plans.
Why not?
After listening to Ed Bastian, I'm saying, okay, let's go to Europe.
Where can we go?
I mean, once you get there, you kind of just hunker down.
We're going to go away together and hug. All right, but let's get to a mad dash this morning. Lowe's is what you want to talk about.
One of the things that's happened, David, is that people keep saying, when is this market going to go down? Well, when the bad news comes, but right now we got good news. Yes, Marvin Ellison announcing a total home strategy, says the numbers are good, could even be better. Comp store sales in the 20s, but then throws in a $15 billion common stock repurchase. And it's got a real strategy. We know that Marvin Ellison is so competitive. They've got robust levels of free cash flow. So, David, you come in and you say this stock is peaked, and we saw the Toll Brothers go down, and people started to talk about a housing peaking. Well, go ahead. Why don't you go against the stock that's up 33%, is buying $15 billion with an incredibly good CEO. This is the tale of the tape, David.
You like this one and you like Home Depot.
Oh, yeah. They're both very good companies. It's very unusual to have both really well-run companies at both places, and you've got them. And Costco's well-run.
And the trend here in terms of, I mean, even if home buying were to slow, home repair and rehab and making sure everything's, that seems to be going anywhere.
People have discretionary income because they're not going out there and carousing or going to sporty events.
Or traveling.
Or traveling, right? There's just so much discretionary income because we're a service economy, and the service economy is like, let's go to the Grand Canyon or let's go to Four Seasons, whatever. No, let's go to Lowe's. Let's make our place look better.
Right.
And David, it's a pretty good investment to get your house going up.
Seems like it. Seems like it. All right, we got a lot more coming up for you right here. Of course, that exclusive with the CEO of DoorDash on that company's initial public offering. Keep it here.
The spirit of performance defines Acura. And now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura's been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
Every day, thousands of Comcast engineers and technologists put people at the heart of everything they create, like Olu Sheyi, a Comcast engineer who grew up bonding with his dad over sports. This inspired him and his team to create AI Highlights technology that uses AI and machine learning to detect the major plays in a sporting event, so millions of fans have a way of catching up on their favorite sports. Learn more at ComcastCorporation.com.
Take a look at the post where DoorDash will make its debut today at the New York Stock Exchange. Jim, you know, we normally talk about this when the IPO market heats up. To what degree does this take oxygen out of the room? But I wonder if you think that's a dynamic this time.
Look, not yet. I think that Airbnb, and then we have Robinhood. And then I think at that point, if people go on vacation and they do another deal, look out, there won't be enough money around. But right now, there's plenty of money. And there's rabid money. I think there's money that basically says we don't really care what that opening price is going to be. David, that 102, 110, 130. You know, David, there's not going to be a lot of discipline in these market buyers. I mean, they're not going to put a price or limit on it.
No, there is expected to be a significant pop at the open at this point. We'll see. Sometimes we get surprised. We give you all of the data on how many times oversubscribed so many of these offerings are. But occasionally, I mean, remember Smile Direct?
Well, could this be Uber? How about Uber?
Oh, my God, of course, Uber. Remember sitting there as their smile started to sort of have to be more and more forced as we watched that thing trade below opening. But in this case, that's not expected. I mean, early on, a half hour ago when I was checking, people were saying 130 to 140.
Oh, come on, really? 130, 140?
Yeah. Now, you got a lot of the people who are in the pre-IPO rounds, who are investors, who actually are getting access to the IPO. Why? Because it's sort of it's a tip. Hey, thanks for helping us out early. Here's an opportunity to flip some stock. So, you know, you got a little bit of that going on, people fighting for allocations as they always do, but we'll see where we open.
It's exciting, Carl, and that's a word that a lot of people fear, excitement. I've been hearing it over and over again. I talk to people say, you know what, how do I get in? This is so exciting. Now, initially, excitement's okay, but remember what Lee Cooperman says, which is that the euphoria stage is always dangerous. We're not there yet. We still have lots of people who went in, $5 trillion in sidelines.
That's true, Jim. And there's some enthusiasm on the sell side on other names as well, which we'll talk about after the opening bell. Speaking of which, let's go to the NYSE. DoorDash, of course, celebrating its IPO today. And as we said, CEO Tony Hsu will join us in a couple of minutes. At the NASDAQ, it's PubMatic, digital advertising technology company, celebrating its own IPO. I thought of you this morning, Jim, because I know Goldman's sell on Apple is annoying to you.
Yes.
But I also know that you don't like the term supercycle, and that's what Wedbush does when they take it to 160 today.
This fellow Ives, I mean, he's doing it, the coal supercycle. Oh, but the fracking sand supercycle. Don't put the jinx on a good situation by talking super cycle. That gets people too excited, David. It brings in a lot of people to just say, how can it go wrong? You know that's not good. You know that that kind of talk, David, has historically not been helpful for investors.
No, it hasn't been. You're right. But doesn't mean they're not going to use it.
5G super cycle.
You know, but what kind of, what you know, when you hear other things from analysts, I mean, for example, I will reference Tesla today, right? And we've got this report out this morning from JP Morgan talking about the addition of the stock to the S&P 500, which will take place on September 21st. Do people want to listen? December 21st. Did I say September? Thank you, Chip. I'm trying to do seven different things here.
Right.
But here's the language they use, and I was just trying to get this up while I was talking there and sort of trying to they say, listen, we don't recommend investors. We recommend investors not weight Tesla shares in their portfolios in equal proportion to the S&P because Tesla shares, in our view, and by virtually every conventional metric, not only overvalued, but dramatically so. For instance, Tesla trades at 1,325 times the last 12 months PE and 291 times 2020's estimated and 175 times the next 12 months. That's not stopping anybody, is it?
No, they're not bound. These younger investors, of which, by the way, Robin is going to get a big valuation, they're not thinking like that, David. They don't care about earnings per share. They don't care about the whisper number. They don't care about what the relationship is for sales. They just believe, all right? And how has their belief rewarded them so far?
Really well.
Well, I rest my case.
Really, really well. Right. In fact, since December 8th, 2018, Tesla is up 808%.
It's created a lot of millionaires, Carl, and people want to be millionaires. It's shocking. They want to be. I mean, I was dealing with someone who's an 18-year-old last night, and the 18-year-old wants to have a very big allocation in Tesla. And I said, why? And the answer was, because it goes higher, stupid. You know, what am I going to do? How do you deal with that? How do you say, well, it can't grow to the sky, and they come back and say, I bought it at 200. What the hell do you know? Why are you keeping me in my chains?
Yeah.
Why are you making it so I can't make money, too? That's what I hear.
Yeah, Jim. Of course, Musk yesterday talking to the Wall Street Journal in that live event, talking about the move to Texas and basically reiterating what he said to employees in that memo earlier in the week or last week. And that is cost discipline is going to be the name of the game going forward as we get heightened competition from other players and new models really coming out from others beginning next year.
But you watch NFL football. Do you ever see a Tesla?
I haven't seen one, no.
Sell themselves. No. 500,000 cars, maybe if they could make a million, maybe
and
they could sell
them.
To
your point, the enthusiasm, Jim, is not just confined to Tesla. Take a look at QuantumScape today.
Oh, I'm working on QuantumScape. I'm working on it.
There was potentially, they said, there was some news out, but it's not clear that it was new news. It has to do with the capacity of their batteries and the ability to, during 15 minutes, to charge to 80% capacity. Now, yesterday, there was a press release out from QuantumScape that said their newly released results based on testing of single-layer battery cells shows that solid-state separators are capable of working at very high rates of power, enabling a 15-minute charge to 80% capacity faster than either conventional battery or alternative solid state approaches. Remember, we had the CEO on when they closed their deal. That was November 12th. They said the same thing.
Right. It's a short
squeeze.
Almost
identical, Jim, in terms of what they told us in the presentation that accompanied the moment that they actually close their deal with the SPAC. I'm not clear to me what was new in what was released yesterday.
Well, no. I mean, once again, they used the magic words, though, David. Next generation solid state batteries. And then you look, it's got a huge, unbelievably good investors. I mean, look at these Volkswagen people they've got. And they've got Stanford University. Anyone from Stanford not become a billionaire? I mean, you go to Stanford, you make a billionaire. It's my backup school. I rejected it. What an idiot. I could have been a billionaire. But you look at these guys, and they're all really fab. And Finnera, the CEO, he worked at Siena. I mean, he's MS Computer Science, David, in Stanford. I want to create a SPAC of SPACs, Carl. Everyone who is computer science at Stanford. I want to give them money, and then I want to go home.
SPAC of SPACs. That wouldn't be a bad idea, actually.
A SPAC of SPACs.
There's going to be an ETF of SPAC of SPACs.
Well, yeah. There will be.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Look at these people. Volkswagen roots, Tesla roots. Carl, I mean, they have everything that you want. And the issue is...
Yeah, but they're repeating press releases, basically.
Well, the issue is
they're
there's
telling
no
us
new
stuff
news.
And it's saying it's new, and it's not really new.
No, but
it's enough to get QuantumScape stock up 25% at 4 a.m.
It's like cereal. It's new and improved. I mean, but the guys have like $1.5 billion in committed capital, 10 years of R&D investment, 200-plus patents, extensive trade secrets. Mm-hmm. David, these are the buzzwords that matter to the younger investors. And yesterday there was such a short squeeze, Carl, that I know anyone who's now listening to me is going to say, you killed the short squeeze. And then David, they're going to say, David crushed QuantumScape.
Oh, yeah,
why? Because he mentioned that there's nothing new.
Yeah, we looked at the language they used, and it was unclear. Guys, if we have just 30 seconds, I want to hit an M&A situation. It was reported by Bloomberg.
Baxter?
And no, Omnicell. I don't know if you saw
that. Baxter.
Oh, sorry. You did say Baxter.
I was trying to be a little more specific.
Yeah, Baxter. It was reported by both Bloomberg and Reuters late in the day yesterday that Baxter had made an approach to Omnicell. Omnicell, by the way, is a company that provides a range of services that help pharmacies, hospitals, other healthcare providers manage and dispense medication and engage patients to improve their adherence to that. There is definitely some overlap in their business, given, of course, Baxter has drug infusion systems, medication management, dispensing solutions. So you can imagine why. What I can tell you right now is there certainly was conversations between the two CEOs. They did talk, and in fact, there was a hope on the Baxter side that they would lead somewhere. At this point, it doesn't appear to. They got to know. Now, they're willing to pay at least $125. People familiar with the situation told me perhaps it would be even a bit more than that. But one thing they're not willing to do at Baxter, Jim, is to go hostile or pursue an unsolicited in the sense of trying to challenge for the board, the window for which, by the way, nominations open up the later part of January. It's a classified board, so it's staggered. But you do have the CEO up during that. But they're not going to do it. They're not going to go that route, I'm told. They're hoping that they can reengage in dialogue, but they did get a no initially. That may be all it is, simply a no. But again, we can tell you that they were willing to at least go to 125, if not a bit above that. Given what they see as a real opportunity here, the company's sales have been hurt this year as a result of the pandemic, but are seen going up fairly substantially next year.
So there you go. You got Baxter up because people think Baxter needs it, I guess, and has been maybe not enough hospital work, and you had Omnicell up. I mean, David, what kills a stock?
What bad news sometimes does still.
Does it?
Yeah, sometimes.
Really?
Yeah, really missing earnings in a big way.
Like who?
I don't know. Like when you have a growth rate that's incredible and a multiple that's unbelievable and you just totally screw a quarter up. But I don't know.
I mean,
not
it's
much.
Just,
is that your point?
Well,
not
just,
much. You can't do much.
Well, you
to
know
go
what?
Wrong
the people
right
didn't
now.
Like the Slack deal.
No. They
that
didn't.
That hurt Salesforce.
What do you think of that $50 billion revenue number he's using for fiscal 26?
Morgan Stanley's, what's it? It doesn't
Salesforce.
Move the needle or the guy like slams it? I mean, hey, look at this. Campbell's Soup. It's down. I thought it had a good quarter.
You did?
Yeah.
All right. Well, there you go. You see?
There you go.
Still some curiosity.
I thought it was a good quarter. Carl, stocks can go down. Stop trading. What can I say? Now it's going up. Oh, Lord help us, Carl.
I'm trying, guys. We'll take a break. As we said earlier, Tony Hsu, DoorDash, going to join us, and then Dwayne Johnson later on today. Got some record highs on the Dow, the S&P, Disney all-time high, 156. Don't go away.
DoorDash pricing at $102 a share last night. It's interesting. Everyone knows what DoorDash is. Valuing the company at $39 billion. Set to begin trading at the NYSE this morning. Here's a treat. Joining us now exclusively, DoorDash co-founder and CEO, Tony Hsu. Tony, First, congratulations. I know this is a huge deal. And it's not like you were born running big restaurants, but you were in the restaurant business when you started.
Absolutely. It's great to be with you, Jim. You're right. I wasn't born in a big restaurant. I was born really as a son to immigrants who came to this country to make a better life for me. And it's, you know, people like my mom, who we started this company for. My mom came to this country, worked three jobs a day for 12 years, one of which was at a local Chinese restaurant. And I got to see that a bit, washing dishes on the side with her. And so it certainly is a big day for all of us at DoorDash. And it's a huge day for all of the businesses we serve as well.
Tony, I think a lot of people interpret your company as being a delivery company. A guy comes, the woman comes to your door, gives you the package, contactless these days. But actually, you are a DoorDash platform that makes a lot of people money, not just DoorDash.
Absolutely. I mean, DoorDash is a platform whose goal is to grow and to empower local economies. We've been fortunate to have generated tens of billions of dollars of sales for brick and mortar businesses and billions of dollars of incremental earnings opportunities for millions of Dashers. Really, if you think about what we're doing, we're bringing online for the first time many of your favorite local businesses that have never been able to compete in the convenience economy before. And so there's a huge economic transformation underneath all of us, and we're there, right there with them, bring them to the forefront.
Now, I know it's a big day for you. I know that you really own the suburbs and small cities, but you did something I think was really special. I want to mention it because I think these are the things that we in the media have to mention. You introduced a new initiative to support Black-owned businesses on DoorDash. Tell us about that.
Well, DoorDash really is a reflection of all of the local communities that sustain us. And if you think about all of the turbulence that we've seen, certainly not just in this year, but frankly, in the past decade, there's been a lot of change, and I think a lot of issues and topics are now getting the attention that they deserve. I think one of them has always been making sure that there's an equal playing ground for everyone. I've always believed that talent is evenly distributed, but access to opportunities isn't. And, you know, whether it's highlighting Black-owned businesses or our Kitchens Without Borders initiative that highlights immigrant restaurateurs for the first time and giving them their shot just like everyone else deserves. That's really what DoorDash is about.
Tony, it's David Faber. A couple of quick questions about just the current environment specific to the pandemic, which obviously has benefited your business. But we've seen a number of your key markets pass what they say are temporary laws to cap your commissions or your marketing fees at 15 or 20% combined. How is that affecting your business right now? Is there a concern, perhaps, that that will actually be extended when the pandemic is over? Or are you able to sort of deal with it by passing it along to the consumer?
Well, let me start by saying that just like everyone else, I wish that the pandemic is over or will be over soon. I mean, I truly wish that we would be having this conversation right now inside Jim's restaurant or inside one of the many fantastic local restaurants in this country. So that's really my first priority, making sure with others to bring forth that solution. I think when it comes to merchants, certainly in the three decades that I've been observing the restaurant industry, this is one of the most difficult, if not the most difficult obstacle that I've seen restaurants to have to overcome. I mean, it's why, for example, we were the platform that cut 50% of our commissions at the onset of this pandemic, why we built products like Daily Pay so merchants can get their payments every single day because liquidity is king in surviving a crisis. It's also why we built many products so that there wouldn't even be commissions on them, whether it's DoorDash Drive or DoorDash Storefront, so that merchants can create more channels to be able to survive this pandemic. I'm super proud of a lot of the initiatives that we've built in order to allow merchants to have six times the odds of surviving the pandemic versus the average restaurant. And for me, it's really about figuring out, you know, how we're going to do that and how we're going to drive incremental sales. And that's why at DoorDash, we've always been more about making sure that we can help merchants grow out of this pandemic instead of, you know, seeing local officials and elected officials try to suppress the demand that go into these stores.
Yeah. Do you ever see, though, pricing coming down for the restaurants? I mention it because there are a number in my area in New York City that encourage people to come and pick up their food themselves and get a bonus as a result of doing that so they can avoid services like yours because they're so costly for them?
Well, one of the things that we do at DoorDash is we both have a marketplace in which we're bringing new customers for these restaurants for the first time, generating tens of billions of dollars of activity for them over the past several years that we've been in business. And the other part of what we do is we have a platform where we create products like DoorDash Storefront that gives small businesses an online ordering solution that they can have that direct relationship with their customers. We build products like DoorDash Drive so that they can actually offer same day and on-demand commerce to their own customers just like we do to ours. I mean, to me, this is about an ecosystem and about an initiative in which we're trying to bring online these businesses. I mean, only 10% of takeout sales in the industry actually happen through a digital connection. 90% of the time, we're still placing phone calls to get takeout orders. We're still driving, to do pickups through drive-thrus and the like. And so if you think about what's happening, we're creating a big transformation to help these businesses come online. And there's a cost to doing that. I mean, we invest hundreds of millions of dollars in marketing to generate business for these businesses. We pay billions of dollars to Dashers so that they can receive the incremental work opportunities that they desperately need, especially in times like the one we're in right now. And we also have to pay for payment processing, customer service, and really take care of the end-to-end experience in order to serve these businesses.
You know, look, my restaurants are mothballed right now, but as a customer, candidly, of DoorDash, the incremental gains are terrific and needed. One thing is certain, I mean, you're growing in part of that because at 200%, which is remarkable, it's even faster than Snowflake. But isn't it true, Tony, some people are going to say, well, they'll never make money. And yet at the same time, if I were in your shoes, I would like to spend as much as I can so that I have the big moat and no one can beat me.
DoorDash has always cared about growth and profitability. I mean, in fact, it's why we revealed in our S1 the cohort economics, I think, that have demonstrated really what the business looks like under the hood. And you're absolutely right, Jim, that we're in the investment phase right now because we're so early into the opportunity. I mean, if you compare this industry with others, 10% of restaurant sales are being delivered today. If you look at e-commerce, they're closer to 20% of total retail sales. And if you look at travel, over 50% of travel sales are now online. So we're playing in one of the biggest yet still most underpenetrated categories in the world. So right now, the time is really to invest.
Tony, a year from now, it seems possible, if not likely, that your sales growth rate is going to slow dramatically given the incredible gains you've had this year because so many people are home using your service. If and when that happens, where are you going to be focusing people on to show that the business is still actually growing significantly? What metrics are you going to rely on to tell the positive story that I would assume you'll be trying to tell, let's call it, 6-8 months from now?
Well, I think we have to think about where secular trends tend to go and what tends to happen once habits are formed. You know, certainly there will always be fluctuations in activity and obviously with tailwinds, there will be changes to the business. At the same while, if you think about how we behave as consumers, once we get used to a habit, whether it's buying things over the internet, whether it's buying travel tickets now through a mobile app instead of through a phone call, we tend to stick to those habits. And when I think about this business over the long run, that's what we're investing towards. We're investing to add new use cases so that we can keep helping these businesses compete in the convenience economy. We're serving other categories like grocery and convenience so that consumers can get everything inside their city delivered to them in minutes, not hours or days. We're building more products so that merchants can build their own end-to-end tech stack and effectively not have to rely on us because that's how they're going to make it in the long run. And it's also how we're going to have a great business partnership for the long run. And we're investing in new geographies. So there's a lot of surface area that DoorDash has as a business today. And I think it really reflects a lot of the strong demand that we saw during our IPO process.
Hey, Tony, a little more broadly, a big story in New York this morning is this proposal to add a $3 tax on deliveries to help fund the MTA. I know it's packages, but I wonder if you fear that municipalities are going to say this is a big structural shift It's a cash cow. It's a way for us to save our tax base, and it's going to test consumer price elasticity over time.
Well, I think that governments have a very tough job to do. And I think that, you know, this is why at DoorDash, we care so much about working in concert with them and making sure that we can provide the best solutions for everyone, especially during a pandemic. And to me, when I think about something like commerce, the way that commerce helps grow GDP inside of a city or inside of a country is we have to maximize commerce. That's how we maximize the number of opportunities for everyone. And when we can grow the economy, that's actually how we get past something as difficult as the pandemic.
Tony, I want to thank you so much for coming on Squawk on the Street. Congratulations on your very big day and all you've accomplished at a very young age. Tony Hsu, founder, CEO of DoorDash. Great to see you, sir. Carl?
Good to see you, too.
All right, Jim, we'll await that opening trade. In the meantime, later on next hour, we'll check in with Dwayne Johnson, talk about his new push into the spirits business, talk about competitive, along with, of course, the media landscape for the year to come. That's coming up in the 10 a.m. hour. Jim, we haven't mentioned the Treasury Secretary's $916 billion proposal from last night.
Yes, I spoke to him this morning, and I think it's got something interesting that people should listen to. $600 per child, $600 per adult, $2,400 checks right to you per family for four. And I think that this is something you're going to hear about, and people are going to say, wait a second, how can we not do this? How can we not give the country a holiday present when we are so beaten down and so many people are out of work? Is it the right unemployment figures for the Democrats? No. But I keep in mind, a check from the government is something that a lot of people may like. And I think there could be a little bit more of a groundswell over this proposal than others. And I think that's very, very significant and should not be ignored. $600 per child, per adult. People want it. They want it badly.
Yeah, Jim, it does seem like we're zeroing in on direct payments as opposed to state and local or liability insurance. Is that a fair trade?
Yes, that's very true. And what I think people should know is that this could be money in their pockets. And I know that there are a lot of issues. I know that the great, though, is the enemy of the good. I think most people in America say it's good to get a paycheck from the get an additional check from the government to augment their paycheck. Or if they've lost their paycheck for no reason whatsoever because of this darn pandemic. What can I say? Secretary Mnuchin,
Jim,
this morning.
We're going to watch that. That's one of the sub-themes today. Along with DoorDash, you're going to have a lot to work with tonight.
Well, plus, I mean, talk about something that is hot button. We have Chevron. Mike Worth. What's a guy going to do during a period when we have a president that is so deeply committed to cutting carbon? Then Kevin Sayer, boy, there is a war over the glucose monitor. Abbott's got a real competitor now with Libre. We got to find out what Kevin Sayer's saying, one of the great performers of this year. I can't wait for tonight. I can't.
That's good. It's going to be excited.
Yeah,
I mean,
Jim.
Look, and then we got Airbnb. I mean, come on, we all use DoorDash. These are common names. We didn't do AI.
By the way, we didn't do AI. Tom Siebel's, I know.
I love Tom.
But the symbol alone should get them a huge pop. How could AI not have been taken?
I don't know, but how about when Frank Slootman told me, because a lot of the younger people like Snowflake. They like the name Snowflake.
I mean, AI, like that would have been, that should have been go-to for.
Shouldn't have been.
Yeah, so many of these.
Well,
companies.
What can I say?
So right there, I mean, they're going to.
Well, back me.
But yeah, we're going to keep an eye on AI too, Carl, this morning. Don't forget about that.
And the Apple
DoorDash,
Super Cycle.
Airbnb, and yes, the Apple. And all the Tesla bulls hate us on Twitter, by the way, Jim.
Oh, everybody hates
for
us.
For citing a J.P. Morgan report that talked about simple valuation, saying we don't know.
But Mark Benioff loves you.
Mwah.
It's a big love fest, guys. Jim, we'll see you tonight.
Thank you,
Mad
guys.
Money, of course, 6 p.m. Eastern Time.
You've been listening to the opening bell on CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.